Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, from a sweltering hot London, where those of you who know the United Kingdom will know that air conditioning is banned, so we're all slowly evaporating in the heat. My name is Phil Middleton. I'm chairman of the Omfif Digital Monetary Institute, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to this session in association with Kroll Associates. We're very, very glad to welcome them and very pleased to have their expertise and input to this discussion. Discussion will last for an hour. It is public. It's on the record. And following it, a full recording will be available for you online. Please, could I ask while you are on to keep your cameras off and your microphones on mute. If you would like to submit questions to any or all of the panel, please use the chat function, send them in to the Omfif team, which behind the scenes as appropriate. Very pleased to welcome a very distinguished panel for us today. Dan Berkowitz, a commissioner at the CFTC, one of the world's major regulators and indeed a major player potentially in this market. Nicole Sandler, head of digital policy at Barclays, a major commercial player, and their view is going to be fascinating. And David Larson and Ken Joseph from Kroll, who are doing an enormous amount of work in this space. This space being today crypto assets, which is suddenly coming into very, very sharp focus. The other day, somebody bought a non-fungible token of nothing for $25,000. I'm hoping one of the panel's going to be able to explain that to me, but just one example of the crypto asset world, which some are arguing will very soon overtake the physical asset world, and indeed all assets will be virtual rather than physical, which is an interesting thought. So we've entitled this Crypto Assets Risks, Opportunities, Valuation. So is this the restructuring of investment portfolios and investment markets in a significant and substantial evaporate along with the current bubble in asset prices? And we will look on it fondly as an aberration. How are regulators going to consider this? Are these financial assets or are they something else? Who should regulate them? How should they be regulated? How do you account for them? What are the risks? How do you value them? So a vast array of topics that we're only starting to scratch the surface of. So I really am delighted that we have got such an expert panel with us. Hope you will submit questions as well. And my role here really is to make sure that none of the panel agrees with each other. So we're going to try and get some discussion, and on occasion I will lob hand grenades into the goldfish bowl and see what comes out. Nobody should take that personally. I will also, because of bandwidth problems, be out off camera when our panelists are speaking. So I'm going to hand over the unenviable task of kicking this off to Dan Berkowitz, and to ask you, Dan, please, could you get us going, A, by defining what the rules of this game are? What are crypto assets? Can we take your definition for us today? And how do you go about regulating them, particularly what's happening in the US, where there are a multitude of regulators, not least the 50 states of the union? So over to you, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Phil. And thank you to Omfif for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here today and to discuss these very timely issues. This world is moving extremely quickly, and I think we'll be discussing that as well today, the ability of regulators to keep pace with all the developments in these markets. And I think the questions that you asked in terms of what are crypto assets and to describe the U.S. regulatory system are somewhat interrelated. As you may be aware, here in the U.S., we have a fragmented regulatory system to address financial markets and financial assets, largely for historical reasons. As our markets developed and the economy developed, and there was a need for the political system to take into account these developments and basically regulate the various innovations in the economy and the financial markets, we developed over time various agencies and entities charged with overseeing or regulating these markets. And at various points in time, that became the commodities regulator. CFTC's predecessor was established in the 1920s. The securities regulation came in the 1930s. We had the Federal Reserve Bank established in the 1910s. And we have various other regulatory bodies that were established along the way. So the U.S., the regulatory jurisdiction is fragmented. We at the CFTC deal with the derivative markets. This would be the futures, the swaps, the options on commodities. They can be financial commodities. They can be physical commodities. The definition of a commodity under the Commodity Exchange Act is very broad. It's anything that you can have a futures contract on at the present or any time in the future. So it can be a tangible commodity, oil, gold, wheat, corn, livestock, or it can be an intangible, such as a financial asset. In that regard, there's futures contracts on Bitcoin, on Ether, and cryptocurrencies under the definition of commodity are a commodity. So from our perspective, cryptocurrencies are a commodity. They're not a currency. They're not a fiat currency, but they're a commodity, and they come within our regulatory purview. Now, our jurisdiction includes regulatory jurisdiction over futures and swaps and options on commodities, but we have anti-fraud and anti-manipulation authority over just the sale of any commodity in interstate commerce. We don't have regulatory jurisdiction. We can't say how you could trade Bitcoin, for example, or how you can trade gold, or what the gold market should look like, or the aluminum market, for that example. But if there's manipulation or fraud in the gold or aluminum or cryptocurrency market, we can bring enforcement actions, and we work with our fellow regulators, Securities Exchange Commission or the Department of Justice in some of these actions. The Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC, is our securities market regulator. So to the extent that cryptocurrencies are securities, those follow in the SEC's jurisdiction, and there's an exclusion from our jurisdiction for something that's in their jurisdiction. So whether a cryptocurrency, you know, can be a security in certain circumstances, other circumstances, it can be a commodity. Just yesterday, Secretary of Treasury Yellen called a meeting of all the financial regulators and met under the auspices of the Financial Stability Oversight Council and said, directed the regulators to get a handle on the stable coins. So it can be a product, a stable coin can be something that's within the purview of the banking regulators as well. So what these things are depends to a large extent on their use case. What they're used for in the marketplace. And our jurisdiction, which I'll speak of a little more, really deals with when they're commodities and in the commodities market. Now, our charter from Congress in the Commodity Exchange Act is broadly speaking to protect market integrity. We also have responsibility to encourage responsible innovation, as well as competition, fair competition amongst exchanges and market participants. So we really have a dual responsibility both to ensure market integrity, that these products are used in a way that doesn't create any systemic risks and that the markets are free from fraud and manipulation. At the same time, we have a responsibility to encourage competition and innovation and to promote new products that may be more advantageous to the economy and to businesses and consumers than the existing products. So we try to balance all those goals in our regulatory approach. And in an emerging technology such as cryptocurrency, where there's tremendous potential, but in any new area, there's also a lot of hype and speculation and potential for fraud. So we have to be cognizant of all those various goals in our regulatory approach.
Thank you. And how largely does consumer protection figure on your mandate from Congress, or is that somebody else's bailiwick?
Market protection. We have most of our regulatory regime is devoted to that. For we regulate the intermediaries in the markets to a large extent. We regulated the futures exchanges called designated contract markets. If you have a facility for the trading of futures contracts, if you offer futures contracts, you have to be registered. Swap dealers, if you make the market in swaps, and you go over a certain threshold on that, you have to register as a swap dealer. If you provide a facility for the trading of swaps, you have to register as a swap execution facility. Futures contracts are required to be cleared on a licensed and regulated through a licensed and regulated clearinghouse, a designated a derivative clearing organization, a DCO. We also have a clearing mandate in accordance with other international regulators and the G20 recommendations. We have a clearing mandate on a variety of standardized swaps, interest rate swaps, for example. And those have to be cleared and go through a clearinghouse, and they have to be traded through a swap execution facility. So many of the facilities for the trading of these instruments, all the facilities of the trading of these instruments are regulated by us. The market participants, there's rules of conduct. There's reporting requirements put upon the market participants. They're prohibited from engaging in fraud or manipulation with respect to these instruments. There's reporting requirements. There's position limits. So there's a number of regulatory requirements that also fall upon the market participants. And so we regulate both the intermediaries as well as the participants directly in these markets. In contrast to the cash market, if you're just trading gold, there's no CFTC regulation that applies to the actual trading of gold. If it's a gold derivative, it's very heavily regulated. But if it's just a gold transaction, it's not, except that the prohibition on fraud or manipulation applies to the to any transaction in interstate commerce in any commodity.
And just a quick question from Lucy Han saying, do you see a distinction between cryptocurrencies on the one hand and NFTs, non-fungible tokens, on the other? How do you deal with that, or is it all one and the same?
Well, again, cryptocurrencies, our concern on cryptocurrencies has been with the derivatives, primarily on the derivatives, on the cryptocurrency. If they're traded as, and we've brought a number of enforcement cases for entities that have offered trading of cryptocurrencies, futures, or leveraged, even in the leveraged transactions, that were not registered. So we've aggressively policed that market. We brought a number of fraud cases in the cash market on cryptocurrency, outright fraudulent schemes where people have been cheated out of their money. People say, we're offering you a 30% annual return if you give us your money, and they get the money and then they buy yachts with it and take vacation. So we've brought those types of cases as well. On the non-fungible tokens, I wonder if it's a non-fungible token, whether, you know, to the extent you would be able to have a derivative market on it, if it's a unique asset. But that is not an area that we have yet been involved with. My understanding is that at this point that would be a cap, more like a cash market. So I haven't seen any derivative markets with respect to the NFTs at this point yet. Not to say that there might not be. I'm always surprised at new developments out there that are happening very rapidly, as I said. But so far, that would be a part of the crypto asset market that we have not become involved with.
Yes, thank you. I find some of the derivative, well, possible derivative applications of NFTs to be a bit like Schrodinger's cat, that they can be two or three different things at the same time. Thank you very much indeed for that introduction. That's got us off to a great start. And I'd now like to move across the Atlantic and come to Nicole Sandler. And Nicole, we've already got questions flooding in around the MICA, the latest great work, which somebody described to me as being MiFID 3 on steroids. But Nicole is head of digital policy at Barclays Bank on regulatory position, particularly in Europe. So may I hand over to you, Nicole, to give us that European perspective on things, please?
Of course. Well, I'd like to also begin by thanking you having me today. I think this is a really interesting panel and one which I think is super important. And I say that because my mum even knows what a crypto asset is, and no disrespect to her, there's no reason why she would have known about this if it hadn't become so mainstream in everyday topics and speech, to be honest. So when I think about DLT and crypto assets, I really can see how they change the way that some people think about assets and how they think about money. Now, taking a step back, if I look at the COVID-19 pandemic, this has really illustrated the importance of technology to increase the resilience of financial infrastructures, and highlighted also the continued digitalization of not just the financial sector, but also everyday life. You know, technology and digitalization, it's played an essential role in enabling remote working, allowing us to be able to do conferences such as today. And it's also importantly played a key role in allowing financial markets to continue to function during this global health crisis. Now, actually, last year, during what I deem as our first lockdown, I remember thinking that the financial markets uncertainty brought about by the pandemic had the potential of changing habits across all of society in looking for technological safe havens. And I thought, whilst this might hasten some of the debate and support for certain crypto assets, it still needed to be a measured and strategic response. And I think it's really important to note that given the cross-border nature of many of these types of assets, that both the industry and policymakers continue to work together across jurisdictions when looking at things like definitions and regulations in order to minimise risks and maximise the benefits. Now, actually, to date, there are over 4,000 different types of crypto assets. I did a panel about 18 months ago where I said there are 2,000 different types of crypto assets. You can see how quickly they're growing. But there's no precise internationally agreed definition of what these are. Rather, there's a variety of terms that describe more or less overlapping phenomena. Now, the understanding and regulatory treatments of what we're dealing with is varied, and there are different classifications both in the EU, the UK, the US and elsewhere. And often these are very broad and potentially require further clarification based on the token's characteristics. Now, as we've seen, attempting to classify and regulate crypto assets is a focal area for policymakers. But a significant proportion of assets actually fall outside of the regulatory perimeter. And what this means is that the user of these assets don't benefit from the same safeguards and protections available in respect of more traditional services and payments, and therefore they may be exposed to more risks. Now, why is classification so hard, and why is there so much divergence? And then why are you seeing things like the MiCA proposal coming out? Well, crypto assets, whilst evolving at pace, as noted by the fact previously there were 2,000 and now we're going north of 4,000, they remain at their early stage in development and their use within financial markets. And the current regulations, they weren't developed with these crypto assets in mind. I mean, I remember sitting in the European Parliament back in 2016, and we were looking at what was then deemed virtual currencies and whether the upcoming PSD regulation would work. And one of the questions was PSD written with crypto assets in mind? And if it wasn't, then how would it work in practice? As crypto assets, and within that I include things like stablecoins, continue to grow in prominence, it's argued that regulatory uncertainty might be hindering its application. And the lack of clarity stems from two principal factors. So first, crypto assets have a variety of features and use cases. There's many different types of crypto assets. They're used to conduct a wide range of activities, and they have varying features and varying risks. The second factor is that there's no commonly agreed taxonomy, and therefore this taxonomy can't take into account the variations and help identify the appropriate regulatory treatment. Now, the divergence isn't an EU or UK specific challenge, it's a global challenge. It's something I'm sure Commissioner sees. He spoke about fragmentation. But when we're looking at things like e-money or definition of financial instrument, in the UK and EU, if a crypto asset looks like e-money, it's probably going to be regulated with e-money. If it looks like a coin or a token and the definition of a financial instrument, by that I mean a share, a bond, a derivative, it will probably be regulated as such. Broadly speaking, a lot of these assets fall outside the regulatory perimeter, say for AML requirements, and this has led to the fragmentative approach to crypto asset regulation. But what it has actually then led to over the last 18 months is a lot of conversations, a lot of proposals, a lot of consultations looking at crypto assets. And this has been very prominent within the EU. So within the European Union, the Commission, after putting out a consultation on crypto assets and their digital finance strategy, after working with the regulatory obstacles financial innovation expert group, ROFIEG, they put out a proposal called MiCA, which is a markets and crypto assets legislative proposal. And what this does is it aims to provide a comprehensive framework for crypto assets, such as payment and utility tokens, that aren't already subject to European financial services legislation. So when I look at MiCA, I think essentially it's been designed to do a number of things. One, it's designed to increase legal certainty in the area of crypto assets. Secondly, it's there to support innovation and promote the development of crypto assets and the wider use of digital ledger technology, DLT. And thirdly, instill appropriate levels of both consumer and investor protection and market integrity in an area that presents lots of risks, but some of them the same as traditional financial instruments. And last, and certainly not least, to ensure financial stability. Now, within MiCA, there is a broad taxonomy, of which the European Commission wanted it to be very broad. There are reasons for this. Firstly, they wanted it to be quite neutral. And secondly, it was to ensure that the proposal remains future-proof, looking at covering emerging types of designs for tokens and different types of use cases that might not have been envisaged. Now, MiCA covers not only crypto assets that are security and not financial instruments, and the definition of crypto assets is actually very, very broad for the reasons I mentioned in terms of wanting to ensure that it's future-proof. Now, within the category of crypto assets, there are three subcategories. An asset reference token. Now, this refers to a type of crypto asset that's intended to have a stable value referring to some other things. There's other things could be a fiat currency, it could be a commodity, it could actually be another crypto asset, and it could also be a combination of those things. There is also another category for electronic money tokens or e-money tokens. And this is a crypto asset where the main purpose is to be used as a means of exchange and therefore purport a stable value by referring to the value of a fiat currency that passed as legal tender. And then last but not least, there's a utility token. And this refers to a type of crypto asset which is intended to provide digital access to a good or service available in DLT. So that's what you had in the EU. Then this year, the UK said, well, we need to put something out as well, because this is a problem in various jurisdictions, or a challenge in various jurisdictions. And so what HMT did is they published a consultation on the regulatory approach to crypto assets and stablecoins. And this paper discussed the current regulatory landscape, and it was made up of two parts. The first part was putting forward the extension of the regulatory perimeter for crypto assets for payment purposes. And then there was also a call for evidence on a range of questions in relation to crypto assets. Now, they acknowledged that there's no currently agreed taxonomy for crypto assets. They wanted to take the FCA broad approach, which is e-money tokens, security tokens, and unregulated tokens, which includes utility and exchange tokens. Now, what HMT said was, actually, there's also the growth and potential in the use of things like stablecoins. And they can play an important role in both retail and cross-border payments as well as wholesale. They said what we may need to have is another category of regulated tokens classed as stable tokens. And so that's another area that they're also looking at. But I think it's really important to note that given the cross-border nature of these assets and the global nature of financial markets, there needs to be a global crypto asset taxonomy. You know, if I were a crypto asset and I started in the UK, I went across to the US and then I went across to the EU, and I went up to China, I went across to Singapore, I would be different in every single jurisdiction. I'd have a different definition, a different treatment. I may have no definition and no treatment and may not be welcome at all. And that is a challenge in something which is so global and crosses borders in ways that we may not have had to deal with before. So we're working very closely with our policymakers and the industry at large, trying to look at how we can have a taxonomy which is more granular than what's been proposed, but accepting the fact that this is very global in nature.
Thank you, Nicole. I mean, this whole question of when and if are we going to get coordination internationally for cross-border crypto assets, of course, is a massive question. And at OMFF, we've been doing a lot of work recently on inverted commas, forthcoming currency wars, close inverted commas in this space, but the international competition around digital currencies. I'm impressed that your mum knows all about this. Probably from her daughter, because my mum certainly doesn't understand it. But in fact, you made the point that the regulation is actually lagging behind the market. And I find it interesting that in the UK, Barclays, amongst others, are preventing customers from dealing in crypto assets. Is this because you believe there isn't sufficient regulatory protection, or that there isn't sufficient understanding of these markets, or some other motivation?
I think it's important to note that we look at all use cases separately when we're looking in this area. So, for instance, if we look at like Bitcoin futures, that is something that we have been involved in. I think it's important as a regulated institution to make sure that we know how we're working within the regulatory perimeter, within our regulatory landscape, and we work with our policymakers to help set out what that is. I mean, you mentioned that it may be lagging behind, and you know, it's always a real challenge, I think, for any policymaker in this area to put regulation out, because things change very quickly, and there's an inherent tension between innovation and regulation. But it's really important that there's a framework that protects investors, that protects consumers. And you don't want to put something out very quickly without understanding what it is that you're working with. But to be honest, that's why I'm such a fan of things like the regulatory sandbox, where policymakers and industry can work together on use cases, seeing how they fit within the landscape and how the landscape may need to change to fit those specific use cases.
But I do find it impressive that in the UK, at least in one or two other countries, the private sector, i.e. banks, are saying, we're going to take it upon ourselves to protect consumers until such time as the regulatory environment evolves to do it for us. And I think there's a very interesting opportunity here for a dialogue between private and public sector in, as you say, agreeing, setting out the taxonomy and the rules of the game for this.
I mean, to be honest, one of the things that I enjoy most about my job is the fact that it's so collaborative with industry and with regulators as well.
Good. I apologise. We seem to have a little bit of a time lag on, I think, at my end between the sound being uttered and it getting through. So I'm very, very rapidly going to hand over now to David Larson, who was a former fellow partner of mine in KPMG for very many years, where he was a leader of the transaction services practice and is now a managing director in Kroll's alternative asset advisory practice. I really would love to hear some of your expertise, David, on how do you value these things and what are the risks that underlie them?
Sure. Thanks, Phil. It's good to be with you, and it's good to take a few minutes to discuss these concepts. And when we get into valuation, I mean, there's a lot of, I'll say, wonder and amazement as you look at some of the where some of the cryptocurrencies values have gone, or at least where they're trading. And I think part of this is, what do we mean when we talk about value, and what do we, and where are we using it, and in what context? You started, I think, Phil, with the question of an NFT of nothing that was sold for $25,000. Well, is that the right value? And what does right mean? And what does value mean? What that means is that somebody was willing to pay $25,000 for nothing and have a claim on nothing. I don't know if that fits into Dan's fraud world. I guess in my limited mindset, it's kind of an interesting concept that you will pay $25,000 to have a digital claim on nothing. But then the next question is, what is that NFT worth, or what is its value? Well, fundamentally, its value is what the next person will pay for it. So if the next person is not going to pay anything, saying, oh, I don't think I would ever pay zero, or I would pay $25,000 for nothing, then maybe its value after that initial transaction could be something vastly different than $25,000. It could be zero. Maybe it's more if the next person is willing to pay more. So that's in this space, if you really simplify it, it's really value is or valuation is, what will the next person pay? But if we take it and look at it more from a regulatory concept or a accounting framework, the way we're used to seeing things, and I'll just try to simplify it shortly into two buckets. One, let's say the corporate bucket, and there's been a couple of high profile situations in the news, and so I'll pick one that's publicly disclosed. Tesla. Tesla has at least discussed at times that they had invested, quote unquote, and I'll use that investment word very carefully in Bitcoin. And then you've got investment entities. And so how do they treat things, and what's the accounting world? What does that tell you how to deal with things? And then what framework do you use for valuing? Just to think about it, whenever we talk about valuation, there's multiple definitions of value. Fair value in an accounting world is, what would you receive in an orderly transaction using market participant assumptions as of the point in time you're valuing? Fair market value is a tax concept. Transaction value is the value that the parties would transact. Intrinsic value may be the ultimate cash flows that are supporting some of those other values. And in the digital or crypto space, that's a very large question is there anything behind it? I think one of the reasons we have stable coins is to try to get something behind it. But if you look at many of the cryptocurrencies, is there anything there other than there's a limited supply, and that limited supply drives demand? From an accounting world perspective, crypto assets are kind of in that bucket of, and I think Dan, you touched on it as it being really, it's more of a commodity. And with the 4,000 different types that Nicole mentioned, there's different ways to look at each of these. So I won't say that this is the only way. So I'm just looking at it from a kind of a very high level at this point. But if you look at a crypto asset, it functions as a medium of exchange, but it's not issued by a jurisdictional authority. It's not issued by a sovereign government. It does not give rise to a contract between the holder and another party. And it's not a securities, at least under U.S. law, of the 33 Act or the 34 Act. So if it's not those things, then it's a crypto asset. And the accounting standard setters have said you treat it as an intangible or other asset, meaning when you put it on your balance sheet, you put it on at cost. You then assess if it's been impaired. If it's been impaired, you write it down, but you don't move the value once you get it. So if you look at the quarterly report of Tesla and look at their digital asset description, it's four sentences in the notes. And they said that they purchased 1.5 billion of Bitcoin, that they had a 27 million impairment, which is start to say, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that they paid a price and then the price dropped for 27 million worth or at the value of $27 million. So they wrote that down to, from 1.5 to 1.3. That's the new cost basis. It won't change from there. And then in the note, they say the fair market value is $2.48 billion. That's what they say about it. So on the balance sheet, if you're buying Tesla stock, you know that you bought 1.37 billion on the balance sheet. If you read the notes, you see it's worth 2.48 billion. It says fair market value. That's an interest. I don't know if that's a typo, but it's an interesting concept because fair value is the accounting concept. So you've got kind of a lot of different things moving there. The moment you start taking payment for goods and services with a cryptocurrency, do you value it based on the last traded price or the last observable price for the cryptocurrency? Or do you value it based on the value of what you're giving up, the car, the house, the non-fungible token, whatever it is that you've given up? What's the value of what you've given up? And again, then you hold it there at that cost level or impair it over time. On the other side, if you're an investment entity, somebody who takes money from other people and invest it for investment returns, for then in that case, you do have to report the value on a fair value basis. You have to do that every time you report to investors, whether that's daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, or whatever it be. And that value generally would again be what would somebody pay in an orderly transaction. So for many cryptocurrencies that you can see a price that's traded, you say, okay, that's probably the best representation. That's where we would value. And some would ask, well, what happens if there's a, if I have too large of a block? Well, the accounting standards don't let you take any blockage discounts. So you're just going to be valuing it at that kind of P times Q price. And then you start to get into probably some of the more important questions that, again, that I think from a regulatory perspective, maybe we're still catching up with. How do you verify that this really exists? And how do you, that this coin that you have exists? And how do you verify that you own it? If you've got kind of some kind of cold storage, maybe it's easier. But if you if you've given it to somebody else to hold for you so you can transact, do you really know that you have claim on it? So those become very difficult questions in the overall context. So I'll stop there, Phil, because given our time, we could go on in kind of a lot of different permutations on thinking about value.
Thanks very much, David. Actually, one permutation to consider, a question from Dave Birch, which is the distinction between a crypto asset and a digital asset, that the former, the value is intrinsic, set by supply and demand, and a digital asset, a value is extrinsic. In other words, the value links to something else. And how do you account for that? Or are we barking up the wrong tree?
So I would articulate it slightly differently. And as Nicole said, there's not common definitions across the globe or across jurisdictions. I would look at digital assets widely. So Nicole's 4,000 different, whatever they are. And a crypto asset is a subset thereof. And so I wouldn't necessarily, it really comes down to what is it? Is it a utility token? Is it a stock token, which we've just seen in Hong Kong that they've stopped the trading of those because that's really a security. Is it something else? And so you really, the first question is, what is it? Then what's observable? What is that last person or that next person willing to pay? And then what is the framework upon which you are valuing it? Are you valuing it to try to make a decision on to transact? Or are you valuing it to do financial reporting?
And while I've got you here, imprisoned, how do we consider a CBDC in this context, i.e. a digital token representative of a fiat currency issued by a central bank of a recognized country? Is this a crypto asset or is it simply a digital payment instrument?
Well, I think that piece is evolving. And it also raises the question, why does one have it? And then if you look at the, I think the U.S. Federal Reserve, they've said, at least I think one of the statements I said is that they see the potential for the current digital currencies to kind of disappear once you get a fiat digital currency or multiple fiat digital currencies issued by various Federal Reserve or Reserve banks or governments. So it's kind of a, I'll say, a hybrid. And at this point, it still says, okay, what's backing it? In some ways, I won't say it is at all the same, but it maybe has some similarities to the ETF market or some of the publicly traded shares markets, where you create an index based on underlying shares, and that trades and that has liquidity. I would look at it a little bit more like that, but I think the jury's still out and people are looking at it different ways.
Thank you. That helps advance the discussion. So I'm now, last and certainly not least, going to pass the baton to Ken Joseph. Ken is a managing director of financial services compliance and regulation at Kroll. He's head of the firm's cryptocurrency task force. And he also served for 21 years with great distinction as a regulator at the SEC. So in a sense, he's been both gamekeeper and poacher. Over to you, Ken, to take us on, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. And thanks, everyone, for joining today. We are in an unprecedented era of financial innovation, and I fear that we may just be scratching the surface of the potential implication for digital assets in the global economy. Risk management involving blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies poses a spiraling web of complexities for risk managers. From the discussion that we have heard to date, I think we have identified at least some of the inputs that any prudent risk management model should contain. I have evaluated these risk management challenges from the perspective of companies that are developing various blockchain solutions, companies that hold virtual currencies, and finally, the regulated financial services firms that trade either for their own accounts or on behalf of clients and customers. And I've tried to distill the challenges and opportunities and place them into at least 22 different buckets of variables, which I believe should form the backbone of any risk management model. First among those is, I think, the very real or perceived prevalence of fraudulent and manipulative activity involving digital assets. Related to that is the significant anti-money laundering concerns. The modeling for the relative lack of common characteristics in the asset class, as we have heard before, custody and data security challenges, volatility, often driven by inequities in supply and demand. As David mentioned, valuation and reliable pricing and price discovery mechanisms, the liquidity risk, also as previously mentioned, the legality of these various instruments. Some of them may be considered legal tender, but in many cases, you run into hostile governments who have not so welcoming attitudes towards the use of digital currencies. There's also the legislative and regulatory uncertainty and the lack of a cohesive regulatory approach at the state, federal, and multi-jurisdictional levels. There's also the risk of changes into monetary policy, the lack of data to adequately model stress scenarios, predicting transaction costs, especially when managing exposures across the some 4,500 different types of currencies that are out there. The impact of speculators is also a concern and should be modeled. The lack of investor confidence, the pace of development of the ecosystem, the accessibility of banking, payments, and settlement services, counterparty risk, fiat currency risk, tax treatment, the development of secondary markets, cybersecurity concerns, and the larger bucket of geopolitical risk. I toss back to you, Philip.
Thank you. Well, that's an excellent tour d'horizon. And I think you paint a picture that this complexity spreads far further than just financial markets. So if I'm, for example, a corporate treasurer in a non-financial institution, whether or not I hold these assets as part of my short or longer term balance sheet. And then we come to the question of which regulator then I then deal with. Nicole, I see you wanted to come back in on something, so on CBDC. So please, can I hand over to you?
It was just a point to note that I think that one will struggle to find a policymaker that will refer to a CBDC as a crypto asset. And one of the reasons for that is for them, a CBDC will be backed by fiat currency. It's public money in digital form. So one of the challenges that one often finds with certain types of crypto assets, or at least which is highlighted, is the volatility. And if I think about the United Nations, I think 180 different types of recognized currencies, and some crypto assets are very volatile. So if I were to go to the supermarket and buy a pint of milk, one day it could be £2, one day it could be £10. In the supermarket, it's probably always going to be £1. If you were using a CBDC, it would be the same price. Using certain types of crypto assets, cryptocurrencies, that may not be the case. So I would say that a policymaker would differentiate between crypto assets and then CBDCs separately, purely because of the volatility and what it's backed with.
I mean, it's interesting because, of course, there's enormous volatility in other non-crypto assets. I mean, for example, foreign currency or indeed certain equity classes. So,
I also think it's worth noting that, you know, they look at diversity of payments. So if a CBDC does come to fruition, that doesn't mean that other types of payment, digital payments such as stable coins, won't also come to the market. You know, if I look at what the FSB and the G20 have been looking at in terms of cross-border payments, they talk about different means, whether it's stable coins or CBDC. So it's a diverse, to me, it's diverse difference, but I do take your point that they're not all volatile, only some.
Ken, could I come back and say, if I were an institutional asset manager, I am looking, as for example, somebody like Ruffer, to get part of my portfolio in crypto assets. What are the big risks? What is it I really need to look at over and beyond what I would call this standard finance? What are the particular risks attaching to crypto?
Yeah, I think in that situation, the biggest issue is around the lack of regulatory clarity. Custody comes a close second in my view, but it's really around the lack of regulatory clarity. Properly functioning markets, of course, depend on investor confidence, which is fed by regulatory clarity. I think many had hoped that the US SEC, one of the leading agencies in this space, especially coming off a strong enforcement push under the former administration, which saw over 70 crypto-related enforcement actions, would have placed a regulatory clarity for digital assets high on its regulatory agenda. It appears, however, that the SEC is prioritizing instead climate risk and board diversity, swaps and SPACs and short sale disclosure, but not digital assets on its current regulatory agenda.
And Phil, if I can jump in, I think that one of the questions I have personally is why are you investing in it? What is it that you think you are investing in? And are you willing to put that capital at risk? Because again, if you start thinking about this from an intrinsic value perspective, what is there behind it? There's a lot of ones and zeros in code, so to speak, but there's not, there's a limited supply of some of these, but that's, and there's a desire to buy them for various purposes, some of which are legitimate, some which could be nefarious. There's a desire to move them around, but at the end of the day, I'm often asked, well, how could a young company be worth $1 billion before it has any revenue and before it has any earnings? Well, that young company at least has an idea. It's developing software. It's developing something to move forward to generate revenue. A crypto asset is ones and zeros. It's worth what the last person paid for it. And I'm not saying that this is a massive, to use one of my grandchildren's stories, Emperor's New Clothes situation, but it's hard for some of us who have been around the block a long time to comprehend what it is and why it has the value that it's perceived to have.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it is. Interestingly, of course, my young daughters see this as being perfectly normal because they, as Nicola
exactly.
said, they're existing in a digital economy where physical ownership of assets, you know, Dad, why do you continue to have to own a car? Well, I want to drive around. Well, yes, but you can take an Uber or you can lease one. Or why do you own anything? Dan, can I come to you and say, given that this is the Wild West at the moment, given that the scarcely a day goes by without warnings from the authorities about the criminal behavior, scams, frauds, money laundering in this. Shouldn't we perhaps say, look, in order to prepare to protect David's grandchildren and Nicole's mum, we should simply restrict these markets to adults only for the moment until we've decided on the rules and the regulations, and that, you know, the denizens of Wall Street know are big boys and know perfectly well what they're doing. And if they lose a few million dollars, well, that's between them and their shareholders, whereas the average citizen could find his or her life substantially ruined by getting involved with these things. And it's a public policy objective to have financial stability and happy voters.
So, well, that's an excellent question. When we are presented with whether to permit trading, say in a Bitcoin future or a derivative on one of our markets, we have a statutory standard that guides our review to this. And one of the key standards is whether the contract is susceptible to manipulation or not, and there have to be adequate safeguards to assure that it's not susceptible to manipulation. We reviewed the Bitcoin futures contracts and the other futures contracts such as Ether and found that they met the statutory standard. Now, whether it is appropriate for somebody to invest in it is not within our mandate. We do issue consumer advisories. We have jointly issued a consumer advisory with the Securities and Exchange Commission on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency futures, pointing out their speculative nature and that it may not indeed be appropriate for everybody. But that's really about as far as we can go. We do have a distinction in our rules and regulations about so-called professional markets. It's not the term, but for example, the swap market, you have to be an eligible contract participant to be able to enter into a swap in a one-to-one over-the-counter transaction with a bank like Barclays, for example. You can't do they could not do a swap with a retail person unless it was done on an approved exchange. And this is because basically ordinary people, you know, can't really understand. Typically, ordinary people don't understand the swaps, you know, have a sophistication to really understand the risks in swaps. So that's a statutory restriction on the swap market. Once an item is on the futures markets, anybody can trade it. And speculation, our markets are speculative component in all our markets is a significant source of liquidity. We have speculation in oil. We've seen a huge amount of increase in retail participation in the oil market within the last couple of years and other commodities, gold, silver, whatever. So retail participation and retail speculation in commodity markets is not new. In cryptocurrency, because as David said, there's no underlying fundamental a value at this point. We're dealing with in this market, we're dealing on speculation as to whether it will have a value in the future. Gold, oil, whatever, there is still an economic value in those commodities today, and the speculative component is what will be the economic worth of these tomorrow. On crypto, we're not there yet, whether there's that grounded value in the economy today. There's proponents believe we'll have it. Others are skeptical, and that's for the investor and the market to decide what the value is based on that. So we are very cognizant of our duties to protect the consumers. But if a product meets the statutory standard in terms of market integrity and clarity of terms and limits on trading and positions and not susceptible to manipulation, then that's about as far as our regulatory authority can say it's not appropriate for consumers. But we do, in situations like cryptocurrency, we will put out a consumer advisory saying, this is something that people really ought to consider whether it's appropriate.
I think similar to the CFTC, the SEC also has an investor protection mission, but it's really a disclosure regime. It does not sort of make investment decisions. And in fact, anyone will tell you investments involve risk. The SEC's concern is an anti-fraud mission. It's also a disclosure regime as well. I think for many, to David's point, we were probably having the same discussions back in the 90s around the dot-com companies. What are these things worth? There doesn't seem to be anything there. And, zoom ahead 20 years later, there are some valid use cases that came out of the dot-com era. And I do believe that if not only in the underlying use of the blockchain for various purposes, there are going to be use cases for cryptocurrency and digital assets. We're at the crossroads right now and trying to weed out, a level playing field, if you will.
Ken, that's an excellent point. And I think just real quick, .com, a lot of companies failed, but a few powered through and we are benefited from that today. I think if you superimpose that on where we are today in cryptocurrencies and digital assets, a lot of these are going to fail, but some are going to power through and will benefit us in the future.
Right. And it's not the role of government to place bets on who's going to succeed versus who's going to fail. I think it's about making sure that there's clarity in the rulemaking and the treatment and let the markets decide.
So essentially, Nicole, Dan, we police the perimeter to keep out the obvious crooks, con artists, scam merchants, but otherwise caveat emptor?
I think it goes to my earlier point, and it's stemming on what's been discussed. There are lots of different types of crypto assets. We need a taxonomy which is broader and a bit more granular, so you know which crypto assets should be treated in which specific manner. But that's how I would look at it. Some should be allowed, some shouldn't be allowed, and there'll be some that we haven't even thought about, which will be very useful in the future. But I think that when we think about crypto assets, rightly or wrongly, I'm not going to give a view on Bitcoin, but people immediately really only think of Bitcoin initially. And their view on crypto assets is just related to that. And that's a mistake because that is one of many, granted the largest, but one of many.
And I would agree with much of what's been said, but I would point out the difficulty, and I think Nicole raised this issue earlier, is from the regulatory perspective in terms of providing certainty. If we had 2 years ago decided, well, look, Bitcoin looks like Bitcoin's the leading technology here. Let's figure out how to regulate Bitcoin. Well, now we've got maybe Ether, and because you can build smart contracts off Ether. So maybe we look at the Ether model. By the time we formulate a proposal, put it out the proposal for public comment, get discussion going, in a year to 2 years down the road, all these markets could be different. If we had tried to, quote, regulate the dot-com bubble in the early 90s without knowing which direction it's going to be going, our saying, okay, here are the guidelines, here are the guardrails that this industry ought to go before it's really mature, we may have stifled unintentionally much of that innovation. So we have to be careful not to get too far out. We don't know where this is going to go. We want to promote innovation and give the industry the freedom to grow. At the same time, we have to maintain the guardrails. And that's a real challenge for us, and how to do that in a timely manner, given the slow governmental, public interaction process that can take a couple of years to really work its way through the system. So it all valid points, but it's a challenge for a government regulator to really keep up in a timely manner.
Could I therefore ask, Nicole, is there therefore a risk that MICA is going to be left on the starting blocks, that the market will have overtaken the regulations long before they're implemented?
I mean, I think MICA is very much a work in progress, and I would like to think that when it eventually lands and is implemented, that it is done in a way that it does factor in future cases. So I know that is what they're trying to do. And we welcome the fact that regulators are trying to put out proposals.
Thank you. And presumably, Ken, with your risk management hat on, you are perpetually scanning the horizon, out in the far future to try and discern how that's going to evolve and what those risks are going to be.
Any good model will have to be flexible. There is innovation, and innovation at a pace that we probably have not seen in financial services space ever.
So do we have the necessary infrastructure in place to manage this risk on a market and a societal level, or are we making it up as we go along?
I think it's rather the latter.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much indeed. Are there any final points any of you would like to the l'esprit d'escalier? I wish I'd said that before we close. Dan?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think we have as a regulator, we have a long ways to go to maintain currency with these markets and to act in a way that provides both the certainty and as well as the flexibility. And that's a tough balance to make. It's going to require continued dialogue such as this. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's going to require continued dialogue between regulators and the private sector, and all around the financial institutions and infrastructures to go forward and ensure ultimately growth in the economy plus protection of investors. So I look forward to continuing this.
So do we, and thank you very much for joining us. Nicole, final words.
Just to echo the Commissioner, I think it's going to be a very interesting few years going forward, and I think there needs to be continued collaboration on something which is difficult for both the industry and the regulators and policymakers, a framework that will work for the future, but I think it's going to be of real value. So I think we need to keep collaborating and working together. I think it's absolutely essential. Cross-border.
Thank you very much for joining us in this. David, somebody has suggested that in the final analysis, the Bitcoin brand may be worth somewhat more than the Bitcoin itself, and that's how you should account for it.
It very well may be down the road, and I think as we see this evolve, some of the regulatory actions will be reactive, some of them may be proactive. But if we kind of look at past history, we're probably likely to be a little bit more reactive over time than proactive. But we'll see how things play out. And as long as people are cautious and know why they're doing what they're doing, again, it is their decision.
Thank you. And the final words to you, Ken.
Thank you, Philip. And I just think that, this industry has been faced with so much hostility, in part because of the prevalence, or as I said before, perceived prevalence of fraud and illegal activity. I think sometimes we ignore or we tend to overlook the fact that there's a significant segment of the consuming public and population and investor base for whom digital assets is very much the norm. And I think the struggle for all industry participants here is to make sure that there is transparency and certainty. We keep the bad guys and gals out of the markets and try to find a way to regulate in a smart way that will foster innovation and adoption. And just think ahead what this would look like 5-10 years down the road.
Thank you. That's a very good clarion call. As both you and Nicole said, we're just really scratching the surface, both in terms of the opportunities and the risks. So I would like to thank Kroll for bringing this topic to our attention, for the risks, the valuation, the accounting. I'd like to thank Dan and Nicole for reviewing for us the policy and regulatory imperatives here. It's been a fascinating discussion. I hope we can repeat it. Thank you very much indeed to our four panelists. Thank you to Kroll Associates, and thank you to the 450 attendees we've had this afternoon from various parts of the world. And we hope we can all join up again in the future to take this discussion further. So thank you and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.